Do you like Wagner at all? Should you? Wagnerism is the title of an aptly girthy new study of the composer by New Yorker classical music critic Alex Ross. The book is Ross's attempt not so much to stare directly into the heart of Wagner, but to catch his reflection, or indeed his shadow, both in his contemporaries and everyone after, from civil rights pioneers to, well, Nazis.
Backshadowing is a very useful concept that the critic Michael Andre Bernstein used to talk about this problem that develops when we read history in light of what was to come, and especially when we see the history of the 19th century and early 20th century as this inevitable, irreversible march toward Hitler. There are many strands of the culture and history of that period which don't fit that model or can be distorted if we only look at it through that lens. This quantity of Wagner and what it means to be Wagnerian keeps evolving and changing as the years go by and as we go from the 19th into the early 20th century. And it's a bit ironic because we think of Wagner as such a domineering and ominously controlling figure who wants the audience to experience everything the same way, you know, according to his principles. But in fact, there's a great deal of chaos right from the start and a great deal of debate over what these works meant. And sort of this kind of multiplication of Wagner's and sort of meanings connected with Wagner. And that's really what the book is about. It's sort of this explosion of responses to this single man and his work in every imaginable direction. It's a kind of singular phenomenon, I think, in cultural history that he had such acute impact all across the arts, and those reverberations continue today. Sure, if I qualify as a full-fledged Wagnerian, you know, certainly I've been fascinated by him for a long time, but I've just always been fascinated by the effect that he has had as much as by the music itself. And I started out really not comprehending his music at all. When I was a kid, I was a very avid listener to classical music, especially the instrumental tradition, kind of Bach to Brahms, a little bit of Mahler and Sibelius there at the end. And when I first tried to listen to Wagner, I was confused, I felt uneasy, I felt slightly sick to my stomach. I was used to this very clear presentation of, you know, here's the first theme, here's the second theme, development, recapitulation. Wagner was all this kind of stream of one thing bleeding into another, and you're never quite sure where you were and where you were going. And so I had this adverse reaction and didn't come back to him for quite a while. It really wasn't until quite a bit later, when I was in my 20s and I was going to the opera regularly as a critic and experiencing Wagner in the theater, that I began to develop an appreciation for the works as masterly psychological experiences, as well as ones that are charged with all of these political questions. And so I've become steadily more appreciative as the years have gone by. But I think, you know, there's this ambivalence always has to remain. You can never sort of quite embrace Wagner wholeheartedly. And I think actually I can never really claim to have gotten to the bottom of it, you know, because every time I come back to it, it sort of means something different. And so it's this ever evolving relationship. And perhaps I'll eventually go back to loathing Wagner, I don't know. But it's always fluctuating in that way. He is German, all too German, extremely nationalist in his views throughout his life. And of course, he's an absolutely ferocious anti-Semite. And that would seem, you might think, that this would have severely limited the appeal of his music to people outside that group. And yet that wasn't the case at all. People were certainly aware of Wagner's anti-Semitism, but especially in the later 19th century, it wasn't a dominant topic in terms of how Wagner was perceived. And even Wagner's Germanness was held somewhat at arm's length. I mean, if you look at how French Wagnerians, beginning spectacularly with Baudelaire in 1861, embraced Wagner as this great avant-garde bohemian figure who represents this liberation of the consciousness and a doorway to the dream state. Wagner's Germanness really didn't enter into their thinking at all. They sort of ignored it almost completely. And then you have this very interesting phenomenon of minority groups, sort of socially marginalized groups, who embrace Wagner as a kind of vehicle to their own potential social and cultural ascent. You know, sort of they're kind of coming into their own. And what happens is that Wagner's model of reviving myth and giving it contemporary relevance is a model for how African Americans, say, can reach back to ancient myth, ancient legend in their own traditions and bring it to life. Irish nationalists sort of looked at Wagner through something of the same lens. Yeats saw Wagner as a model in that way. The Catalan Wagnerians, and of course I talk about the Jewish Wagnerians, and that's a very sort of difficult phenomenon to really encompass, because I think the Wagner's Jewish fans at the end of the 19th century were coming from several different directions. It was not monolithic at all, but you did have this astonishing fact that Theodor Herzl, at the time he was writing The Jewish State, his prophecy of the Zionist state, was regularly attending Tannhäuser at the opera in Paris, and said that only on the evenings when he did not see the opera was he not inspired by his idea. In other words, somehow witnessing the opera was integral. It impelled the development of his ideas. And that's remarkable, but it's a sign of how Wagner can leap beyond his specific context and become a model to people of all different backgrounds and traditions.
Alex Ross there, author of Wagnerism, and we'll have the second part of that conversation next time on Culture File.